Welcome to Sydney and to the HIV-TB Satellite Symposium. My name is Diane Haviler. I am professor of medicine at UCSF and chair of the Stop TB HIV-TB working group. My co-chair for the symposium is Dr. Soumya Swaminathan. Soumya is a pediatrician, and she is a TB researcher and leading the HIV-TB research program at the TB Research Institute in Chennai, India. I would like to thank the Sydney Organizing Committee for allowing us to have this symposium, to the IAS for featuring HIV-TB quite prominently in this meeting. I'd like to thank the Symposium Planning Committee, speakers of participants, which are listed here, and the many sponsors for the meeting. I would particularly like to thank Veronica Miller for all the work of herself and her staff from the Forum on HIV Collaborative Research, and Haile Jesus Gedahun from the WHO for his work in putting this symposium together. Veronica asked me to call your attention to a JID special supplement on HIV co-infection, which is available online and will be a print edition in August. So as we all know, living with HIV in most parts of the world means living with TB. Although TB is a leading cause of death in persons living with HIV, we've yet to define optimal strategies to treat and prevent both diseases. This symposium is designed to highlight research priorities and ask a panel of some of the most influential leaders in the world on HIV about their vision and commitment to HIV-TB research. As way of background, I would like to say I think we've seen an impressive scale-up of resources for implementation of HIV and TB activities through the Global Fund. This year, for example, PEPFAR allocated an additional $50 million specifically targeted as plus-up funds for HIV-TB activities added to the $70 million, leading to $120 million for implementation of HIV-TB activities. Despite this acceleration in implementation funding, I would say, honestly, research has been slow out of the starting gate. As you'll see in the symposium today, there are many unanswered research questions that we already know of, and certainly, as the rollout goes forward, many new ones are already arising. This, then, is the focus of this symposium, and this is the challenge. While we are accelerating implementation, how do we support financially and conduct research that improves outcomes of both diseases? It is our hope at this meeting in Sydney that we look back as this is a turning point of the commitment and action dedicated to HIV and TB activities. The way the symposium is going to be set up today is that we are going to have four speakers give 10-minute presentations on four priority areas in HIV-TB research. Following that, we will ask our panel to come up to the front, and each individual on the panel will be asked to speak 3 to 5 minutes about their vision and commitment to HIV-TB research. This will be followed by an interactive discussion among the panel members and with the audience about priorities and way forward in HIV-TB research. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. I'm Dr. Stephen Lawn, familiar to many of you. Stephen is a faculty member at the University of Cape Town and at the London School, very active and prolific, a researcher in the HIV-TB area, incredible on-the-ground experience, and he's going to summarize for us the research priorities in HIV and TB.
Good afternoon. First, I'd like to thank the organizers of this symposium for asking me to speak on this important topic, research priorities in HIV-TB. I'm going to start by setting the scene, just briefly describing the impact of the HIV-associated TB epidemic on TB global control. Thereafter, I'm going to illustrate some of the key research priorities using data from Cape Town. So it's very much a view from the field. And then finally, I'll address a very simple question: why should TB-HIV research be such a high priority? In 2005, it was estimated that 2 billion people were co-infected with Mycobacterium tuberculosis, were infected with Mycobacterium tuberculosis. There were 8.8 million new cases of active TB and 1.6 million deaths. The vast majority, some 7.4 million of those new cases, were in sub-Saharan Africa or Asia. In most parts of the world, TB incidence rates have been declining since 1990 in middle and industrialized countries. But in two parts of the world, the former Soviet republics, and particularly sub-Saharan Africa, those countries with high HIV prevalence, TB incidence has been steadily increasing. HIV has been particularly an important factor underlying the 1% global rise in annual TB incidence between 1990 and 2003. There are signs that the tide might be turning, that TB incidence rates are declining, but it's a sobering thought to realize that in the middle of the first decade of the 21st century, there have never been so many new TB cases each year in the world today as ever before. And there's a lot of work to be done to meet the Stop TB Partnership goals to reduce TB by 2015. The HIV-TB epidemic is principally concentrated in the countries of southern and east Africa, where over 50% of new TB cases are also HIV co-infected. In Botswana, when a DOT strategy was introduced in the mid-80s, subsequent to that, TB incidence rates steadily increased from 1990 onwards due to the impact of the HIV epidemic. It's becoming increasingly clear that the DOTS WHO strategy is insufficient alone to control this epidemic. In 2005, a WHO meeting of regional ministers declared that this epidemic was a regional emergency requiring urgent and extraordinary actions. That begs the question, what are those urgent and extraordinary actions? I think the truth is we don't really know. What we need to fuel this activity is urgent and extraordinary research. I have the privilege of living and working in Cape Town, South Africa for the past 2 to 3 years. And I'm going to describe the challenges of HIV and TB in this setting, in the TB clinic, in the community, and in the antiretroviral clinic. This township in the South Peninsula is a well-demarcated township of around 13,000 people. It's a poor township and has a single primary healthcare facility where TB treatment occurs using the DOTS strategy. Within this clinic, there's been an astounding rise in the burden of TB, rising a number of cases per year, rising from around 30 per year to nearly 180 per year. And there's been a disproportionate increase in extrapulmonary and sputum smear negative TB, which is obviously difficult to diagnose and presents a huge challenge to the limited staff in this clinic. Two-thirds of these people are HIV infected. Retreatment rates have increased from 3% to 24%, despite the use of a six-month rifampicin-containing regimen. 87% of those retreatment cases are HIV co-infected. Mortality rates among HIV-TB co-infected patients in sub-Saharan Africa are high, up to 30% of patients dying during the course of TB treatment in the absence of antiretroviral treatment. Within the community, the rates are staggering in this township. Between 1996 and 2004, there's been an increase from around 500 cases per 100,000 to 1,500 per 100,000. And this has been paralleled by the increase in HIV prevalence from 6% to 22% among adults. Using this age-stratified analysis, the number of TB notifications on the y-axis can be seen to increase year by year, with each of these subsequent lines, difficult without a point, I'm afraid. But you can see that the predominant increase has been among 20 to 49-year-olds. We can see that in 1996, the TB incidence rates steadily increased with age in adulthood. But since then, in 2004, the rates have increased staggeringly. Among 30 to 49-year-olds, these rates have reached 3,000 per 100,000. There's also a new epidemic of TB among adolescents, traditionally the golden period of TB. And you can see that on the lower graph, HIV prevalence has plateaued from around 2001. But despite that, the TB notification rate, the line above that in solid, has increased with an ongoing amplification of the TB epidemic despite that plateauing of HIV prevalence. This is presumably due to ongoing evolution of the level of immunodeficiency among that population. If that burden of TB isn't staggering enough, when you do active case finding, the story gets worse. A 10% population sample was studied in this community, and the HIV prevalence was found to be 23%. 3% of the population also had TB. In black, it shows TB that was already diagnosed, but in red and yellow is the proportion of TB that was microbiologically proven but as yet undiagnosed in the community. 9% of HIV-infected patients had pulmonary TB. Only 5% had been diagnosed in the clinic. And the case-finding proportions among HIV-negative TB was reasonable at 67%, but among HIV-infected patients, it was only 37%. So there's been a staggering increase in TB caseload in this community, and this has been replicated right across southern Africa. There's a huge burden of TB, of undiagnosed TB, among HIV-infected patients. And worryingly, symptoms were poorly predictive. DOTS alone is insufficient. And in this community, the DOTS program has been running since the mid-90s with reasonable cure and treatment outcome rates. So there are many issues. How to best diagnose TB in this setting? How can we improve DOTS? What adjunctive strategies do we need to supplement DOTS? Active case finding, isoniazid prophylaxis? What are the sources and the sites of TB transmission in this community? The challenge of TB in the antiretroviral treatment clinic. TB is being concentrated in antiretroviral treatment clinics, such as the one in Guguletu, the township next to the airport in Cape Town. When patients are referred to this clinic, there's a one-month screening interval to prepare the patients for treatment and to diagnose TB and other opportunistic infections, and then they start treatment. Again, the burden of TB is staggering. 52% of patients enrolling have had one or more episodes of TB previously treated. A quarter have active, prevalent TB, either recently started on treatment or as yet undiagnosed. And a further 10% develop TB during the first year of treatment. And overall, a third of our patients have overlapping TB treatment and antiretroviral treatment in the first year. The burden of TB during treatment decreases sharply. But you can see in the first 3 months, the rate is extremely high at 23 cases per 100 person years. All these patients had new onset of symptoms in the first 3 months of ART. And undoubtedly, these patients had subclinical TB at the time of screening that wasn't detected. This raises an important question. How do we exclude or how can we diagnose this TB before we start antiviral therapy? Secondly, you'll note that the rate at the end of the first year is still 4.5 cases per 100 person years. And the rate plateaus at this in the long term. After 3 years, it's still 4.5 cases per 100 person years. So rates don't reduce to background during antiviral therapy. And on the right there, you see that the rate, 4,500 per 100,000, is many-fold higher than the background rate in the community among HIV negative or in the whole community. And so with these patients living much longer during antiviral therapy, the contribution of TB to the community is much greater from these survivors. And this will potentially undermine any beneficial effect of ART on TB control. So there are many questions arising from this. How do we screen for TB on arrival at the antiretroviral treatment program? There are many issues relating to the delivery of concurrent treatment. How do we diagnose, manage, and prevent TB immunoreconstitution disease? Infection control is a huge issue, and the effect of antiretroviral therapy on treatment on TB control. So there's a very broad research agenda that can be broken down into four main categories. We need basic epidemiological research to measure the burden of TB in these communities and measure the impact of interventions. We need research on new tools and interventions, new diagnostics, screening tools to detect TB more easily. We need new treatment strategies. We need research to improve existing interventions such as DOTS, such as isoniazid preventive therapy. And we need health policy systems research to see how all this can be delivered within the confines of health systems in these developing countries. So I'm just going to highlight five of these key research areas: diagnostics, case finding, preventive therapy, infection control, and integration of TB and HIV services. We're using a diagnostic test in most parts of the world that was invented 120 years ago. And among patients with HIV and co-infection, the sensitivity can be as low as 20%, which is wholly inadequate. There are many new TB diagnostics on the way. Serology is very easy to use, but has very poor performance. Other more highly performing technologies, though, are not easy to use and not applicable at the point of care. We are desperately in need of a test that can be applied within the clinic. In our clinics in the township, we can diagnose HIV within 15 minutes using a rapid test. But with TB diagnosis, often we're waiting 3 weeks for the result of a sputum smear of a sputum culture. And we are fortunate to have culture facilities available in Cape Town. Active case finding. There are many unanswered questions. How can we target HIV-infected patients more easily? How can we increase VCT efficiency? What other groups should we be targeting to reduce transmission? We need an effective screening tool and new diagnostics. Isoniazid preventive therapy. It seems that many working in the field regard this as a very effective intervention right under our noses. But there are many questions remaining. Although it clearly works, how can we implement it? How do we exclude active TB before starting treatment so that we don't give isoniazid monotherapy to active TB unwittingly? What is the risk of drug resistance? How long should we treat? How can we improve uptake and compliance? How can we overcome issues of co-toxicity with other drugs? There are confusing data arising from Botswana, from the CDC Botusa project. In 2003, the initial studies seemed to show that to exclude active TB, symptoms and signs were an adequate screen. A chest X-ray was not needed. But at CROI in Los Angeles in 2007, it was found that 12% of asymptomatic HIV-infected patients had an abnormal chest X-ray. 9% had active TB. And indeed, in Cape Town and elsewhere in Tanzania and Zimbabwe, studies are finding high rates of subclinical but active TB. And this could obviously be a source of isoniazid resistance if we roll out IPT programs. A meta-analysis showed that there was a trend towards an increase in resistance, but this was not significant. But the risk may be much higher in high TB incident settings under non-research conditions. It seems that no data exists to show that isoniazid prophylaxis doesn't increase resistance. But we cannot be sure on this. The country policies on IPT reflect this confusion. Botswana has a program for HIV-infected individuals, but now the screening strategies are somewhat confused. Kenya has dismissed IPT as an intervention after national consultation, and Burundi has funding for an IPT program, but now wants to reprogram this into operational research to answer the many unanswered questions. Infection control. TB has been concentrated in our ART clinics and medical wards. In Guguletu, in the township I showed earlier, one in three patients has TB at program entry or during the first year of antiretroviral treatment. This is a huge hazard. How can we screen again for potentially infectious patients? How can we care and prevent TB among our healthcare workers? What interventions are needed? How can we use airflow in an achievable way, ultraviolet light? What is the efficacy of these interventions, and how can we study these? Then integration of TB and HIV services is important, but some marriages need a lot of work to make them happen, and this is no exception. In Guguletu, our TB and antiviral clinics are a mile apart and run by separate city and provincial administrations. We need good models of how integration can be achieved at national, regional, district, and clinic levels. We need to demonstrate the benefits. It's hard work making these systems come together, and people have to really buy into the benefits of this. We need to overcome concerns about nosocomial TB transmission and other difficulties. And finally, why should HIV-TB research be such a high priority? I think the traditional model of research funding has been based on the following: the level of interest from pharmaceutical industry, interest groups, the level of advocacy, media exposure and donor interest. Secondly, how answerable are the questions? And thirdly, how attractive are the data to the research community? Are they novel and are they publishable in high-impact journals? But I think a novel approach is needed. What is the potential for reduction in disease burden? What is the impact on equity? Is it answerable? What is the likelihood of efficacious interventions being developed? And will it be deliverable? I put it to you that in the case of TB and HIV-TB, all these are yes. The burden of TB is huge, and it's impacting communities that are the most underserved and underprivileged communities on Earth. These questions are answerable. We will and can find interventions if we put our minds to it, and these are deliverable on a large scale. So to go back to Maputo in 2005, a regional emergency requiring urgent and extraordinary actions. These urgent and extraordinary actions must be informed and made possible through urgent and extraordinary research. I'd like to thank my colleagues at the Desmond Tutu HIV Centre in Cape Town, Robin Wood, Linda Gale, Karen Middlecoop, Glenda Meyer, Matasim Badri, and the rest of the staff there. I'd like to thank Halieyesus Getuhon from Stop TB and WHO for his discussions regarding this talk. And I'd also like to thank the Wellcome Trust who fund me and the NIH who funded some of the studies in the townships in Cape Town. Thank you.
Steve, thank you very much. That was a terrific distillation, I think, of the key issues and where we're at, particularly with the operational research questions. When we have the discussion period, if you have questions for Steve, he'd be happy to answer those during that time period. What we'll do is just go consecutively through our four speakers. So our next speaker is Dr. Jerry Friedland. Jerry is professor of medicine at Yale University. Jerry, along with his South African colleagues, recently reported the outbreak of XDR in Tekulaferi in KwaZulu-Natal in The Lancet, and we asked him to come and speak about XDR and the research priorities in this area. Jerry.
Good afternoon, colleagues and friends. I'd like to thank the organizers as well, and actually ask for and all of you for gathering for this session. I'm going to follow up on many of the issues that Steve discussed, but more specifically, thank you, related to XDR and MDR-TB, as was my challenge. In some ways, this has been the year of MDR and XDR-TB, starting out a little more than a year ago with the CDC-WH report on the global XDR-TB picture, the first time that XDR-TB had been defined. It seems like we've been living with that term for a very long period of time, but it's only a little more than a year. The global distribution, the fact, interestingly and importantly, that Africa, India, and Southeast Asia were notably largely missing from the representation of XDR cases, not because they don't exist, but because they hadn't been either the technology was not available to identify them or they hadn't been reported. And also HIV was not recorded in that report because this was entirely from TB supranational reference laboratories. Soon after that, our own report in rural South Africa and Tekulaferi appeared, and with much higher than expected rates of both MDR and XDR-TB. Clearly HIV associated, and that 90%, actually 100% of those identified with XDR-TB were also HIV infected. There was clear evidence of nosocomial transmission and an extremely high mortality of 98% in the 53 cases that we identified. Since then, there have been global burden estimates of MDR and XDR-TB with 400,000 to 26,000, respectively, of each. These, of course, are estimates. Many expert meetings, recommendations, WHO, CDC, NIH, the forum, national and international meetings such as these. And then very recently, there was the ASPE, which I'm describing as the Airborne Single Patient Event, which also contributes enormously to this issue. So when the first report came out in the March of 2006, there were 17 countries on all the continents that were known to have XDR-TB, confirmed cases. And since then, to May, 1 year, there are now 37 countries that have reported XDR-TB, and those are listed and also seen on these red dots. And again, if you notice, Africa, India, most of Southeast Asia, the place where the world's greatest burden of TB is not really represented in these figures. And in addition, these data are really anecdotal, referral samples, and not really population-based, so that we really don't know the incidence or prevalence of XDR or MDR-TB in most of these areas, and certainly not XDR-TB, except for just a few countries, Korea, Latvia, the United States, and also a little Tugela Ferry in South Africa. So MDR and XDR-TB, I think we can say, uncovers past and current deficiencies in TB knowledge, strategies, and programs, and clearly illustrates the global nature of TB drug resistance. And for high TB and HIV prevalence areas, it threatens the success of both Stop TB and historic antiretroviral rollout, in addition to the disastrous consequences for individuals and communities. And for high TB and low HIV prevalence areas with high HIV incidence in many parts of the world, it really alerts us to an ominous danger into the future. So I'm going to focus really more on elaborating research priorities in this area, although I will address and present some bits and pieces of data that I think would be interesting to you. So there are really broad and complex areas of need, of course, in epidemiology and diagnosis and treatment, in organizational issues and delivery of services. And I think we tend to get overwhelmed by this entire enormous array of need. And it's useful to try to define them in short and longer-term approaches, goals, and solutions so we can focus efforts, I think, initially on really what short-term goals, what short-term issues, what short-term approaches would really have the greatest impact in what is in many parts of the world now, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, an emergency situation. Among these things, I think, and it was mentioned, operational research strategies are essential. And, of course, implied in all of this is an enormous increase in need for resources. And I won't discuss that. There will be plenty of people on the panel who will. So I wanted to get back to these two, what I'll call case studies of MDR, XDR-TB, the Tugela Ferry situation, and also the ASPE, or the single airborne single person event. And on the face of it, they would look like they're extraordinarily different events in the course of tuberculosis and drug-resistant tuberculosis. In Tugela Ferry, there's high TB, MDR, XDR, and HIV prevalence. The 53 cases that were originally reported now actually for MDR are over 450, and 55% of them, or 260-some-odd cases, are XDR-TB and 45% MDR. So in a period of about 2 years, the figures have actually increased fivefold. The mortality, if there's any good news, has dropped from 98% to 85%. Unrecognized, and I think without enough attention, the mortality among individuals with MDR-TB in this environment approaches 65 to 70%, and 90% of individuals are HIV co-infected. So that's one part of MDR-XDR. Now we have the single case by way of contrast, but there are a lot of similarities between the two that actually, I think, in many ways illustrate the deficiencies and the places where we need to go in terms of our priorities, as different as they are. So there are diagnostic limitations in Tegelafairi in South Africa with no microbiologic monitoring as TB therapy has been used over the last decades. So no real appreciation of the creeping increase in drug resistance. And there were diagnostic limitations and delayed and discordant and very confusing results with ASPE, both reflective, I think, of the deficiencies and neglect and tuberculosis diagnosis over the years. Standardized treatment for both in the face of this in Tegelafairi and in sub-Saharan Africa is partially responsible, I think, for amplification of drug resistance, and standardized therapy in this instance with the individual case was initially, of course, inadequate, inappropriate, but without documentation of what drug susceptibility might be. In sub-Saharan Africa, TB control programs, very poor outcomes, the HIV epidemic and this KwaZulu-Natal strain, which appears to be at least as virulent, certainly no less virulent than other strains of tuberculosis, have all contributed to this firestorm. We don't have too much to say about the individual case, but clearly lack of attention to transmission. And what I would say puzzling and almost unbelievable attention or misattention to transmission in the individual case really highlights the issue of transmission of MDR and XDR-TB, in this instance in very different settings, in community and in an airplane at 35,000 feet. The absence of treatment options or the limited treatment options that both situations really illustrate, and a whole array of ethical dilemmas which time won't allow to go into but are raised by this issue of individual health versus public health. So they're not so far apart, actually, and there's a lot that we can learn from both of them. Oops, sorry. Okay. So I'm going to go through some of those areas that I mentioned very briefly. So in terms of epidemiology, there's a desperate need for epidemiologic characterization and interventions. And I'll classify them roughly and somewhat arbitrarily, but I think usefully, into short-term and long-term interventions and characterization. We really need to have a more rapid response to investigate hotspots of XDR and MDR-TB and not rely upon the standard WHO surveillance procedures. This is really an epidemic situation and not one of continuing tracking of epidemic trend, of resistance trends over time. And the response to actually the instinct response to trying to find out what is going on is really being a rather slow and inappropriate surveillance rather than outbreak investigation response. So we really need to know more quickly what actually, where the most important areas are. There needs to be more work on the determination of type and site of transmission, acquired versus primary, and we feel that primary transmission has been most important, as well as nosocomial and community, with nosocomial predominating, and interruption of transmission. With all of the diagnostic, therapeutic questions that might be asked and resolved in the short and long term, probably the most important thing that can be done quickly is to think of strategies that would result in interruption of transmission now. And many of those revolve around infection control procedures, practices that are implementable even in resource-limited settings, but have really escaped notice or attention and desperately need to be addressed. In the long term, of course, standardized surveillance is critical, and understanding the relationship between resistance, virulence, specific strains, biologic approach to understanding epidemiology and transmission is critical. In terms of diagnosis in the short term and long term, There's a desperate need for modern, rapid MTB diagnosis, drug susceptibility testing, first and second line at the point of care, it was pointed out. And in terms of short term, I think we still need to explore the idea of trying to separate out by clinical algorithms and maybe microscopy those individuals who are more likely rather than less likely to have drug-resistant tuberculosis and identify and apply some sort of separation strategies. And not enough work has been done on that, and that can be done quickly. Expansion and availability of existing technologies. There are opportunities to expand the laboratory procedure that we have, although inadequate in terms of time, but nevertheless essential in terms of making the diagnosis of MDR and XDR-TB. An expansion of second-line drug susceptibility testing in existing labs that do culture. Most of the labs in Africa and in South Africa that are able to do TB culturing and drug susceptibility testing have not been doing second-line drug resistance testing, and therefore, how can you make the diagnosis of XDR-TB? You can't. Testing available, promising rapid tests, mostly rifampin-based, as you know. An expansion of rapid tests to include sentinel second-line drug susceptibility testing. The rapid tests that we have now are all rifampin-based, and that will not get to the issue of XDR-TB, but only MDR-TB. In the longer term, once these rapid tests are shown to be useful, widespread availability, and I think we need an enhanced and more respected approach to diagnostic research, which sort of is somewhere in the operational, translational, or applied, and doesn't have the same credibility as more basic research. But in this situation, I think we're really witnessing problems that has caused. So encouragement for diagnostic research is incredibly important. And one of the greatest deficits in this whole area is the training and retention of laboratory personnel in resource-limited settings. Wind up. Okay. And I'll just very quickly mention the desperate need for new drugs and shorter regimens. But in the short term, I think there are opportunities, as with HIV, to speed up drug evaluation and approval with tuberculosis. And I've listed some of those. It's important to know about drug interaction with second-line drugs and HIV. And it's incredibly important to develop novel treatment delivery strategies for second-line drug treatment. In KwaZulu-Natal now, it's still required that you go to the central TB hospital in Durban in order to start second-line therapy, and there's a six-week wait in order to actually be seen. And this is true in other parts of South Africa. So that how can we possibly actually address treatment, even if it's available under those circumstances? It needs to be decentralized and community-based. And I've mentioned a number of long-term treatment issues. In the issue of HIV and TB, it was mentioned universal access to antiretroviral therapy is critical to decrease susceptible population. It's probably the best treatment we have now for XDR-TB is actually improving immune competence. Strengthening TB programs, of course, and operational research or programmatic collaboration and integration. And again, to say one more time, there's an urgent need to interrupt transmission. And just to give you an example, on the left is an individual who was treated for drug-susceptible tuberculosis successfully, and 3 months later, new area, new lesion, had acquired XDR-TB nosocomially and expired. In the short term, the focus on developing, implementing, and monitoring site-appropriate infection control strategies and study the effectiveness of these strategies individually and in combination. We'd love to show you these, but perhaps at another time, and just conclude that in the long term, of course, and this is very long term, we need vaccines and alleviation of the social and economic conditions and health disparities that breed both TB and HIV. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. I know there's a lot we could discuss on MDR and XDR, but we're running out of time, so I'd like to invite Dr. Mark Cotton. He works at the Stellenbosch University, the Tygerberg Children's Hospital in South Africa, and he is going to speak to us on pediatric populations. What is the research agenda?
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you to the organizers for asking me to come and speak to you. These are some of the areas that TB and HIV have in common, and there are quite a few of them. I'm not going to read through all of them, but they include biomedical and social adherence issues as well. Just comment on point number six is that virtually every child who has neglected HIV has chronic lung disease, and one needs to diagnose TB on the background of chronic lung disease. So how many clinical trials have actually been done in childhood TB? And this is a PubMed search that I attempted just in preparation for this talk, and I had to look quite hard, and this is what I found. They're not many, actually, when you consider how many children are treated for TB. So childhood TB does contribute significantly to the caseload, and an estimation is about 14% of the total burden. Incidence in children in the Western Cape is around about 400 per 100,000. So TB is very common in HIV-infected children. And incidence data was worked out by Heather Zahr and myself and colleagues in the Western Cape in the setting of limited access to antiretroviral therapy. And it's 23.4 of each 100 HIV-infected children will develop TB each year. TB is also common in acute pneumonia. And this is just the most recent evidence that comes from Lisa McNally and colleagues from KwaZulu-Natal. And what you see is in patients both HIV-infected and uninfected presenting with acute pneumonia and not responding or getting better within 48 hours, you can look at the large percentage of children, especially HIV-infected, who have acute pneumonia that is due to TB. So the presentation and outcome diagnosis have been fairly well described in some prospective and a lot of retrospective studies. The virological and immunological outcome in children are less well described, and there's not that much long-term data on heart. This is in the absence of heart, just showing how TB exacerbates the HIV-related mortality. This is a study from Ethiopia. One such study that's helped with the clinical description is from Annika Hessling, where she documented a poor response to standard anti-TB therapy and a high mortality, often due to opportunistic infections and also recurrent tuberculosis in culture-confirmed cases. So the diagnosis of childhood TB, certainly in the absence of HIV, is becoming a lot easier. And again, a study by Ben Murray from Stellenbosch, who looked at a symptom complex with a very, very high predictor value for diagnosing TB. Induced sputa have become more popular with a higher yield than gastric washings, and this is the data from Heather Zahr from Cape Town, and various new diagnostic tests are being evaluated and need to be evaluated. This slide also just makes the point of the long delay for actually translating the diagnosis of TB and especially culture confirmation and sensitivity confirmation, the long gap and time where one has to make clinical decisions in the absence of laboratory data. Duration of therapy, unsatisfactory response to a six-month regimen has been documented in adults and children. A study has been completed in Cape Town. The results are not out yet. And there are a couple of other, this is comparing 6 versus 9 months, and there are a couple of other studies that have shown 6 months is not great. So drug resistance in children is increasing, as data from Simon Scarf in the Western Cape. And children reflect ongoing transmission in the community, so need to be considered in any consideration of drug resistance. So it is possible to do large prospective trials in HIV-infected children. One has reasonable case definitions, one has radiology, skin tests, and one can get specimens for culture. One of the important mechanisms is an endpoint review committee or an impartial expert or experts to review cases and x-rays. This is a one such study that was conducted recently which supported INH prophylaxis for HIV-infected children as a routine strategy. And there was a significant difference in death rate. None of the kids were suspected of having TB, and of course the INH did result in a lower incidence of TB. This is another study which is ongoing. This is the IMPACT 1041 study. The acronym is at the bottom, and it's one of the networks sponsored through the Division of AIDS, which is a large, very large, well-designed study looking at INH prophylaxis as a primary strategy in exposed and infected, HIV-exposed and infected infants. Three centers in South Africa and another three in sub-Saharan Africa to open quite soon. What about the absorption of anti-TB drugs in children? Not that much, to my knowledge, is known about this, but here's a study by Steve Graham looking at ethambutol and PZA in Malawian children. Of course, the absorption worse and in the young infant, the young kids, and if they're HIV infected. The timing of ART and anti-TB therapy has not been studied. I'm not sure if it should be. I think they should all be treated myself. I think I'm just going to go on to the next one. In terms of antiretrovirals, the rifampicin interaction with efavirenz has recently been studied by colleagues from Cape Town, showing low levels with and without rifampicin, and also showing that lopinavir with boosted ritonavir gives you therapeutic levels. And because ritonavir is a hard drug to take with a short half-life, we're now looking at double-dose lopinavir-ritonavir in the setting of rifampicin. Rifampicin also increases the clearance of zidovudine and maybe even abacavir, and I guess that needs to be looked at. So here's a pediatric-specific issue, and that's BCG given to all neonates, certainly in Africa. And the WHO has just given a cautionary or advisory note warning about the dangers of immunizing HIV-infected infants and even suggesting that maybe one shouldn't. BCG prevents disseminated TB, and according to work by Annika Hessling, a retrospective study and now being confirmed in a prospective study, an extremely high rate of disseminated BCG in HIV-infected infants. This is some of her retrospective data, really just showing that it's a problem. The next point is that new drugs for TB, as they're being developed, children have to be included. I don't think one wants to look at my slide number 2, having so few examples of studies in childhood TB. And then when it comes to MDR, children have to be included as well. Bill Berman from Denver has shared the strategy of optimized background therapy plus new drug or placebo, and children should certainly take part in this kind of study. both for treatment and for post-exposure prophylaxis. So to summarize a research agenda, I think there's still need for prospective natural history studies looking at all permutations of TB and HIV. Pharmacokinetics, there's good information. I think we need some more. BCG is an absolutely critical question that needs to be looked at very, very urgently. The new diagnostic tests need to be applied to childhood TB, and transmission in healthcare facilities applies to infants as well, probably through the parents and maybe even through the infants. I've already mentioned some of the TB issues, really a plea that children should just be involved in this. So this is a newspaper article on funding for TB-related research, and when you compare it with the Trident missile system and the amount of research that smallpox gets, the amount of funding, maybe we need a bit more. And I want to acknowledge some of the colleagues who've helped me shape this talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. We know the challenge for children begins right from the diagnosis of HIV, which itself is problematic in most developing countries where access to nucleic acid tests is not available. And I'd like to add one more issue, and that is the issue of malnutrition, which I think is cross-cutting across all these research areas that have been mentioned. Adults and children who are malnourished definitely don't do as well, both with anti-TB and antiretroviral drugs. The next speaker is Dr. Javier Blanc. He's a pulmonologist who works at the Bicetre Hospital in Paris, and he's here representing the ANRS. And he's going to update us on planned and ongoing clinical trials. Where's the momentum?
Well, dear colleagues, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me, especially Veronica Miller, to address this issue of the update of current and planned clinical trials about HIV and TB co-infection. So if you consider that you've diagnosed TB and HIV, you know that clinicians face a lot of problems with the treatment because of high pill burden, drug toxicities, immune reconstitution, inflammatory syndrome, paradoxical reactions, adherence challenge, and so on. So they definitely need some strategy trials to have them. I identified three strategy questions in adult patients, not dealing with prevention or so on. The first one could be which heart regimen in that situation. Second one, when to start HIV treatment. And third one, how to better diagnose or manage IRIS. This later point won't be addressed further for that symposium. Brief on the methodology I used to gather these informations, I only focused on registered trials that exist in international database. I mentioned two websites that I've accessed 3 days ago to check all the information, and also I directly contacted some of the PIs and the studies. For example, if you do a query on clinicaltrials.gov, mentioning TB and HIV as a condition, you will find 30 studies, but only 14 remains once you've excluded trials focusing on prevention or latent TB, vaccines, basic science, nutrition, adjunctive therapy, which is a very good, interesting study about corticosteroids adjunctive treatment in normal TB, not pericarditis or meningitis. Observational study, and once you've discarded one, duplicates. So first question, which heart regimen? These are the three theoretical possibilities. The one in red is the main one used in low-income settings. But today there is no large prospective randomized clinical trial published. So we can face four questions in this situation. First one is the efficacy of a once daily heart regimen. Second one is it better to use nevirapine or efavirenz? Third one, if we use nevirapine, 400 versus 600 milligram per day. And the fourth one is, do we have data on pharmacokinetics? So I will address only ongoing or planned trials, not summarizing any trials that have been already published. So first question, efficacy of a once-daily heart rate treatment. We've got the BKVR study, which is a phase 3 French pilot trial in naive co-infected patients, dealing with the efficacy of Truvada plus efferance regimen in naive patients. The primary endpoint is viral load undetectable and TB cured at the end of the trial. The first inclusion occurred in January 2006. There are currently nearly half of the target, and the study will probably be completed at the end of 2008. In that study, as in many others, you've got a lot of secondary endpoints. I won't deal into that because of lack of time. And for each trial, I mentioned the contact information for a contact person. So you've got email address if you want further information. Second question, nevirapine 400 versus 600 milligram per day. So this study is being conducted in Thailand. In HIV-1 infected patients with CD4 cell count below 200 at inclusion and proven TB. Primary outcome is a virological one. The study started in October. The target is 100 patients, and the date of completion, the estimated date of completion, should be October 2008. Again, you've got the information contact. Now we've got three studies dealing with nevirapine or efavirenz. The first one is a Thai study, including patients with CD4 cell count below 250, and at inclusion, AFB-positive TB is not mandatory. The heart regimen being tested is D40-3TC plus nevirapine or efavirenz. Primary outcome is also a virological one. The study just started in January 2007, but I've got no information about the target and the date of completion. Second study is an Indian study. Roughly the same inclusion criteria. The heart regimen is a bit different. It's DDI plus 3TC plus nevirapine or efavirenz. Heart is begun at the end of the intensive phase of TB treatment. The primary outcome is also a virological one. The study started in June and is estimated to be completed at the end of December 2009. 180 patients should be enrolled. All these studies, or most of these studies, only include adult patients. The third one is a French one, which will start in Mozambique. So this is the design of the trial, CD4 cell count at inclusion below 250, active TB, 4 weeks of anti-TB treatment, then efavirenz or nevirapine. The primary outcome is a bit different. It's also a virological outcome, but also death at 12 months. This study is expected to start in September 2007. Target is 570 patients, and the study should be completed in 2 years. I will only briefly mention the PK studies. I could gather three of them. Truvada plus efavirenz in Tanzania, with inclusion CD4 cell count between 50 and 350, and smear-positive pulmonary TB. So this study is expected to start soon. Second one is dealing with rifabutin and nelfinavir or efavirenz. And the third one is about ritonavir boosted by lenacapavir in Thailand. Second question, when to start heart? So you should distinguish the level of immunosuppression. The first study is called the PART study. It deals only with patients with CD4 cell count higher than 350 at inclusion. And there are two arms in that study. The first one is to begin heart at inclusion. The second one is to delay heart until CD4 cell count drop below 250. Of course, all these patients are treated for TB. The heart regimen is AZT-3TC abacavir. The study started in October 2004. The target is 350 patients. The actual enrollment is 150. I'd like to mention that all the studies dealing with the timing of the best timing of introducing IRVs You could imagine how difficult it is to conduct such studies in, especially in poor income countries. So don't be afraid of maybe slower than anticipated recruitment. All these studies are now ongoing and recruiting quite well or quite rapidly. So I'm quite confident that we will have the answer for all these studies, despite maybe slower than anticipated recruitment. The second one deals with patients with CD4 cell count between 220 and 500 at inclusion in four African countries. It's a WHO-sponsored trial that just started. The start of the study was a bit delayed because of problems with shipping drugs in the countryside, but now it's okay. And all sites will begin enrollment in August. So there are two arms in that study, combined heart with anti-TB drugs versus delay heart after the end of the 6 months TB treatment. The heart regimen is AZT3TC plus efavirenz. It's a very big study with 1,900 patients, and the date of completion should be 2011, not before. The third study deals with much more immunosuppressed patients because CD4 cell count should be below 200 at inclusion. This study takes place in Cambodia. It's a good example of fruitful collaboration between two sponsors, the French NRS and the NIH Division of AIDS, through a CIPRA grant. Basically, all the patients receive the same TB treatment and the same heart regimen, that is D40-3TC plus efavirenz. The only difference between patients is the timing of introduction of ARVs, early, that means 2 weeks after the onset of TB treatment, versus late, 8 weeks after the onset of TB treatment. The primary endpoint is survival. Only patients that are IFB positive on any smear can be included with CD4 cell count below 250. The study started in January 2006. The target is 660 patients. The actual enrollment is 289. You can see the curve of the inclusion. So it started quite slowly, but now it increased. And we hope to finish this study at the end of 2009. There are three PIs of that study, a Cambodian one with Dr. Sok Tim, an American one with Dr. Anne Goldfeld from Harvard, and myself. The fourth study is an SATG study, dealing exactly with the same question, with roughly the same inclusion criteria, except that AFB-positive TB is not mandatory. Patients also have CD4 cell count below 200 at inclusion. ART is initiated within 2 weeks after TB treatment onset versus 8 to 12 weeks after that. The primary outcome is the proportion of patients who have survived without AIDS progression at the end of the study. The study started in September 2006, and I've got no information about the date of completion. The heart regimen being used is Truvada plus efavirenz. And the last study dealing with this issue is what I call TB meningitis study. It deals with the same question, but in patients who have TB meningitis. The primary outcome is also mortality. ART is begun immediately with TB treatment or deferred 2 months after the initiation of that treatment. So to conclude, despite some general difficulties in funding and sometimes slower than anticipated recruitment, we hope that the following studies could answer these two questions in the next 2 or 3 years. First one, which ART regimen? Second one, when to start ART in patients treated for TB? If we have a look at a publication in January 2006, there are still some gaps. Some priority areas for research and evaluation have been identified so far. And this is a list of questions that still remain to be answered. And for further information, you are welcome to read this article that will be published in the August supplement issue of GID, and a regularly updated table of that paper can also be found at the following websites. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Javier. I'd now like to invite our panelists up onto the dais. so that we can start our panel discussion. Dr. Michelle Kazachkin, Dr. Debrework Zodi, Dr. Charles Magone, Dr. Javier Blanc, Dr. Michelle Sidibe, Dr. Kevin DeCock, Dr. René Redzon, and Dr. Barbara Lawn. Please, would you like to join us on the dais? What we would like to do over the next 30 to 40 minutes is to have each of our panelists speak for a couple of minutes on their vision and mission from their agency or organization viewpoint. We've heard all the research priorities that have been listed. There are many, many challenges, and many of them are clinical challenges, and there are many operational ones as well. And as researchers, we need to balance these two. Quite often we have answers to things, but we are not able to implement them when it comes to the ground. So I think a lot more attention needs to be paid to implementation and operationalization as well. So I'd like to invite our first panelist, Dr. Michelle Kazachkin, who's presently the Executive Director of the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria.
Do we speak from here? Yes. Okay, thank you very much, Sophia, and Diane. Good afternoon. I will make a few short points regarding funding by Global Fund of TB in the developing world, and how does the Global Fund, in its current ways of intervening, deals with some of the questions that have been discussed earlier today. The first point is that the Global Fund is currently the major funder of TB in the developing world, in addition, of course, to the own effort of the countries themselves. The Global Fund currently represents 66% of the overall international funding for TB. We're funding programs in 102 countries out of 130 eligible countries for Global Fund funding, and this represents a committed amount of $1.9 billion for 5 years. China, I must say, represents a very significant part of that funding. The 1.9 billion over 5 years committed also translates in almost 1 billion for the first 2 years of approved programs, and of that 1 billion or almost 1 billion approved for the first 2 years, China would represent over 20% major grants there. And the region, in fact, the Asia region, is largely funded. In addition to China, we're funding large programs in India and Indonesia. The second point I'd like to make is that the Global Fund is not funding research, as you know, not funding basic research, not funding clinical research, but the Global Fund is open to funding operational research, provided that the operational research program comes to us within the country request for funding, and this is an underused mechanism at this time. The third point deals with the latter, which is that to emphasize, but I'm sure this is everyone here is familiar with that, that the Global Fund is not a top-down funding mechanism where we would decide somehow in Geneva, you know, which would be the countries to fund with the programs, which would be the programs to implement, and how to implement them. The Global Fund is a bottom-up mechanism. So it is up to the countries to decide on which type of program they want to implement they would then submit a request to the Global Fund in a round system. We now have one round per year at a fixed date, the call for offers being launched on the 1st of March, and then those proposals would be assessed by an international and independent panel of experts, and if approved, then proposed for funding by the board. The fourth point is that because of that bottom-up characteristic of the fund, I really turn to my colleagues, particularly those who from the UN agencies, WHO, UNAIDS, to stress how important it is to all of us, and particularly for countries that want to access Global Fund funding, that the technical agencies provide the necessary support to the countries so that TB and TB-HIV co-infection come high on the agenda of the country, and therefore comes high in the proposals that we receive at the Global Fund. But not only would I turn to the UN agencies, I would also turn to you, René, and certainly to you, Deborah Work, because I know how much both the World Bank and Gates, to some extent, fund the civil society. And it is, as you know, the entity that writes a country's proposal that comes to the Global Fund is not a governmental entity. It is what we call a CCM that brings together the government, but also the civil society. And we know that the non-governmental sector is particularly important in implementing TB care in a number of countries, particularly in the Asia region. And then it's as important, I suppose, that the civil society, the non-governmental sector, is empowered and funded to be a strong implementer and strong participant in the design of the grants that are submitted to the Global Fund. In fact, our board has recently encouraged now the countries to submit to us proposals where, with what we call dual-track funding, that is where one principal recipient would be from the government, the other principal recipient would be from the civil society or the non-governmental sector. And this is already the case for some of the major grants, TB grants we fund, for example, in India. And then my last point will be that the Global Fund mechanisms for funding are not adapted to respond to an emergency. Because of our round system, because of the time to respond to the call for offers and then the time to assess the proposal, to sign the grant, and to start bringing in the funds. So we do have to look for complementarity with other mechanisms that could respond to emergency situations. And Jerry, you clearly pointed out that the necessity of having mechanisms adapted to respond to emergency. And I'd just like to inform everyone here that we're in current discussions with UNITAID a roadmap will be designed together with UNITAID and proposed to both the board of UNITAID and the board of the Global Fund in September and October. And in the mechanism we're trying to work out with UNITAID, UNITAID will be in a position to immediately respond to an emergency and send in drugs for resistant TB or funding for XDR-TB at the condition that at the same time when the country receives or agrees to receive funding from UNITAID or drugs from UNITAID, the country would commit to submit an application to the next round of the Global Fund, so that we then have the Global Fund coming as a relay to UNITAID. These are the points I wanted to make, and I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Dr. Deborah Work-Zaudi from the World Bank.
Thank you. Thank you, and thank you to the organizers for inviting the bank. What I would like to do in the 3 minutes that I have is to first of all tell you where the bank is involved and then raise some of the research issues. But upfront, what I would like to say is compared to the response the bank has shown to HIV/AIDS, we ourselves acknowledge that we haven't paid that much attention to TB. And this is something which we have picked up recently and hopefully would be implementing this much faster and much closer to our involvement in HIV/AIDS. The involvement of the bank, both on HIV/AIDS and TB, is in many countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Most of the examples I'll be using will be from Africa. We support TB programs in a number of areas. The first one is through the sector-wide approach, where a substantial amount of resources, more than about $7 million, go into the strengthening of the health sector in terms of budget support and systematically strengthening service delivery, which includes HIV/AIDS. The second area is the multi-country HIV/AIDS program for Africa, a $1 billion project and $155 million project for the Caribbean. In these, again, a substantial amount of this fund has been going into TB treatment. More importantly, the treatment acceleration program that we have in 3 countries in Africa, Mozambique, Ghana, and Burkina Faso, to roll out HIV/AIDS treatment has TB services as part and parcel of this treatment. We have, as many of you know, we have just concluded a health system strategy for our health, nutrition, and population unit of the World Bank. And part of that strengthening of the national health systems would be strengthening delivery for TB and related infections. We also put a lot of emphasis in increasing our analytical work and policy dialogue with countries regarding TB. More importantly, we are harmonizing and working very closely with efforts of the World Health Organization, the Global Fund, the Stop TB Initiative, and more recently, the Africa TB High Burden Coalition, where the bank would be playing a significant role. We would also use our analytical capacity to conduct assessments in select high burden countries to determine financing and program gaps, as well as opportunities for stronger collaboration between the HIV/AIDS and TB programs that the bank and other partners are funding. XDR-TB, like other organizations, we have also focused on it, and the bank is working very closely with the XDR Global Task Force. More particularly in the Africa region, we have now revamped our personnel to deal with TB, and there is a new strategy which is being articulated for Africa. It's called an agenda for action for HIV/AIDS, and the most important part of it is to deal with the HIV/TB co-infections. Turning to research, and based on the excellent presentations this afternoon, there are 3 areas where the bank would, with our other partners, would like to join hands and do some of the vital research that is needed. The first one would be clinical, new ways to optimize the management of co-infected individuals, when to start and stage therapies within the new context of emergent XDR-TB, development of new drugs and diagnostics. This is an area where we would be more than happy to join hands with our partners. The second area would be epidemiology. How does HIV drive the TB epidemic and vice versa? And what are the population-level impacts of AIDS treatment on incident TB? And finally, on operational research, how to implement TB and HIV programs to ensure that they strengthen and synergize. ensure appropriate and prioritized allocation of resources to health systems and co-design and co-implement TB and HIV programs to foster a true continuum of care. So this would be the areas that we would look to the Global Fund, WHO and UNAIDS to work with closely, and I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Our next panelist is Dr. Charles Magone from the EDCTP.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to start by saying what EDCTP is, and then briefly, how do we carry our activities. EDCTP was the European Community's response towards the poverty alleviation in Africa through reduction of poverty-related diseases of HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. The aim of the program first is to integrate the European national programs on these three diseases, and then to work in partnership with African governments as well as third parties. The integration of the European national programs aims at creating synergy among the European scientists who are working with their African counterparts. In the past, there was a lot of fragmentation in many of the programs being carried between the North and the South. And the involvement of the African partners is mainly to instigate and create ownership as well as ownership of the program as well as of the agenda itself. Again, in the past, quite often, things were always top-bottom. Partners in Europe decide to have a program, and then they have, in the past, they would have had a counterpart in South, mainly based on former colonial ties, like we have institutes in UK working with particular institutes in Africa, institutes in France working with particular institutes in Africa, and we are trying very much now to remove those gaps. And by working with the third partners is to add value, and by third partners here I mean public-private partnerships, product development partnerships, philanthropic agencies, as well as other institutes in the North. Recently, the approach of EDCTP has changed a bit, where now we are basing clinical trials as the main vehicle of carrying out our activities. And capacity development and networking is added value. Because we always talk about doing capacity clinical trials in developing countries, but quite often the capacity to do the clinical trials tend to lack, both in terms of personnel as well as enabling environment, things like, for instance, sound ethical review, regulatory framework. So the aim of the program is not only to carry out clinical trials, but to build the capacity to conduct these clinical trials, as well as to improve the environment for conducting these clinical trials so that the clinical trials are conducted under best practices internationally as anywhere else in the world. Our method is now, again, usually bottom up. In other words, before we conduct any clinical trials or before we decide to put up a call, we call we call a stakeholders meeting, whereby all players, people from African communities, scientific communities, policymakers, people in the private industries, and as I said, public-private partnerships, as well as product development partnerships, we sit together in a usually one-day kind of meeting and thrash out the common areas. In the field of tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS, we've had four major stakeholders meeting recently, one on HIV vaccines, another one on HIV treatment, and one on TB treatment, and another one on HIV vaccines. Based on this, we decide what are the molecules which are in the pipeline, what are the studies which we think are likely to benefit the scientists. And together, after deciding, then we put up calls. And for the three diseases, we had put up a call on TB vaccines in the 6th of July. This is open and will remain open until 19th of November. There was another call on TB treatment. This will be put up in the 1st of August in 2 weeks' time and will remain open until September this year. For HIV treatment and HIV vaccines, we will put up calls early next year, hopefully sometime in February. Besides these direct HIV and TB-related activities, we also support clinical trials in general, and one of the modes we're going to do is put up a grant again in early August, 1st of August, to conduct or to set up centers of excellence for conducting clinical trials on 4 main regions in Africa: East, Southern, Western, and Central. This, we've noticed, is important because there are some areas that tend to be very weak. If you look at most of the activities on clinical trials that are conducted, they are mostly in the southern part and the eastern part and some areas in the western, and hardly anything in the Central Africa, for instance. Take an example of what was presented this morning only on tuberculosis and HIV co-infections. You may realize most of the work seemed to come from Southern Africa. This is not just because the problem is the burden of the problem is there, but also because the expertise tend to be there and tend to lack elsewhere. And this is what where we strengthen the South-South networking and the mentorships in our programs. The other activities, which as I said, tend to lack the ethics and regulatory framework, and we look to do this with other partners, in particular the ethics work we're doing with WHO, but we're also doing a regulatory framework with other agencies, including the European Medicine Agency, EMEA, as well as WHO again there. So in summary, besides putting up funds for conducting clinical trials, we strongly support the improvement of capacity, and we're looking to do this a lot with the third parties, especially from the northern part of the world. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Magoni. I would really like to request our other panelists to restrict themselves to 3 minutes so that we have a little bit of time left over for some discussion. I'd like to invite Dr. Reni Redzone from the Gates Foundation.
Thank you. Before I start my comments about the Gates Foundation, I first want to acknowledge the passing of George Comstock this week. Dr. Comstock was an American epidemiologist who spent his life working on tuberculosis and had given us many pieces of information specifically about isoniazid preventive therapy as well as BCG. He was over 90 years old, and he had spent his entire life on TB. So I just wanted to acknowledge his work and his dedication to TB. I think the speakers have emphasized the importance of TB and HIV and once again brought home the point of it's not a question of if people with HIV in Africa will get TB, but when people in Africa with HIV will get TB, and the looming and terrible problem that this is. The Gates Foundation certainly acknowledges the importance of TB and HIV infection as a very important part of both HIV and TB. To date, the foundation has funded the CREATE project through Johns Hopkins, which is headed by Dr. Dick Chason, and Gavin Churchard is also part of that. He is here in the audience, looking at different methods of dealing with HIV and TB. I want to reiterate what Michelle has said, and that is the incredible importance of civil society in making sure that policymakers and stakeholders are well aware of this. There is support to civil society activities. Mark Harrington is one of the people that has worked very, very hard, and the Gates Foundation, it is a pleasure for the Gates Foundation to be working with him. But then more basic problems in TB certainly relate to the problem of TB and HIV and certainly drug-resistant TB, and that is that there needs to be a better diagnostic, full stop. It needs to happen. Current diagnostic methods are not sufficient, and we need to work on doing that. And also, there need to be better treatments that can both shorten the duration of treatment and also offer treatment to resistant TB. And the foundation is also dedicated to delivering that. The final thing is, of course, vaccines. The best way to prevent any infectious disease is to have a vaccine, and the foundation is dedicated large amounts of resources to looking at the development of TB vaccines. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to invite Dr. Michelle Sidibe, who's Deputy Executive Director, UNAIDS.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thanks to invite us to be part of this panel. Let me start by just reflecting on experience we had with HIV/AIDS. If we take 1 minute and we try to look at back, we will find clearly that a combination of powerful activism, political advocacy, and commitment from, I can even say, pharmaceutical industry and AV investment, Madam Chair, help us to really find a test which could be even carried out in some cases at home levels. And more than a dozen of drugs with a different mode of action. But if you take 1 minute and you compare that to the TB situation, all our TB drugs, diagnostics, and vaccine date from the last century. I can even say the century before that. And let us be frank, and I heard you presenting the different results, is very difficult to manage the response to TB with the current level of research. The lack of progress is not surprising. If you look at really what type of investment is made, the U.S. National Institute for Health spent almost $3 billion in HIV/AIDS, when we can say that HIV/AIDS research compared to TB, less than $150 million. So it's clear that if we maintain the same level of investment, it will be very difficult to make the difference and to find those diagnostic and different tests which could be certainly most appropriate to respond quickly to this major challenge. Because we should not forget that one-third of the 40 million people who are infected with HIV/AIDS today was also infected with the TB. The activists are already talking about a need of an increase by fivefold. We need probably 2 billion annually if we want to make a quick difference. I don't want to spend too much time on that, but I want to come back to what UNAIDS could do. First is, or doing, is to build on experience built with civil society activism and use their expertise and their knowledge to certainly create a movement around TB advocacy. Build their capacity to increase better demand for TB prevention and research. the last board of UNAIDS called all the member states to invest more in TB. And we are convinced that we are not talking about a different agenda. We are talking about one agenda, HIV and TB. And more, we will reinforce our collaboration with different partners in the field, and particularly with, of course, Global Fund. We are working closely together. WHO, we have a permanent staff now working in UNAIDS Secretariat with us to help us to certainly better strategize with the World Bank and other colleagues who are investing in this area. I will stop here.
Thank you. Dr. Kevin De Kock, who is the head of the HIV division at WHO.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, colleagues. I'll try and keep my comments brief and try and emphasize some of the public health issues and questions that have been raised from this useful discussion. Obviously, there's no one agency that can address all these issues. The need and the performance of partnerships has been well demonstrated in the discussion. At WHO, there's at least three departments that work on TB, on some of these aspects of TB, the HIV department, the Stop TB department, and the TDR, the Tropical Diseases Research Program. I think a useful way of looking at the whole issue, one has to look at the whole issue in a bidirectional sense, looking at HIV from the perspective of the community dealing with TB and the perspective of the TB patient, and then the other way around, looking at tuberculosis from the perspective of the HIV community and the HIV-infected patient. This an important question that's come up several times is to what extent these approaches, the approach to both diseases should be integrated or coordinated. That's what could spend long talking about that, but the point I want to make is that that should actually be amenable to being examined in a research perspective in a way that brings integrated care to where the patient actually presents and yet maintains the expertise that's very necessary for both diseases without diluting it. From the TB perspective, some of the important issues are testing every patient for HIV. If the patient is positive, that's both patients with TB and with suspected TB, delivering cotrimoxazole prophylaxis if the patient is HIV infected, and then delivering or referring infected individuals for ART. In all of that, I think we've done moderately well, and WHO, who's at the global level, who's one of whose main tasks is the delivery of guidance and technical guidance. Over the last year, I think important guidelines have been published on cotrimoxazole prophylaxis and ART in adolescents and adults, published last August, and more recently in May of this year, on provider-initiated testing and counseling in healthcare settings, the delivery of HIV testing in healthcare settings. And the importance of that kind of advice is not that other people cannot give it or already know it, but that it's a sort of a benchmark that's set at the global level that becomes a minimum standard of practice and in some instances a permission to do things that previously had not been done. I won't comment on the many individual research questions that have been raised, but I think a question that does perhaps need more emphasis, which I don't think was discussed, was how to prevent recurrence in the HIV-infected patients, which remain substantial even in individuals on antiretroviral therapy. From the HIV perspective, I think we've done less well. Important issues that have been raised are screening HIV-infected patients for active tuberculosis, obviously treating them if they have active TB, the issue of preventive therapy, and that of infection control. And ways of looking at this are to discuss what new tools we need and how to better use currently available tools. As far as new tools are concerned, we I do see somewhat of an analogy between HIV and TB. The endless discussions about the quest for an HIV vaccine has been going on, I think, as long as the endless quest for better drugs for tuberculosis, shorter regimens, and better diagnostics. And it is frustrating how slow progress has been in these areas, but they're obviously immensely important. I do think we still need deeper thinking and more imaginative thinking that leading to asking the right questions. I was struck by Stephen Lawn's presentation. The severity of the problem in South Africa, in southern Africa, is quite unique. It is a perfect storm, if you will, of tuberculosis and HIV coming together. And I cannot help but feel that any of these current approaches that we've been talking about actually are not going to do it, and that we need to be asking some kind of question about what kind of population level interventions could be assessed, either for people known to be HIV infected, focusing on them, or even more broadly at a community level. I want to make a comment, a generic comment also, about the missed opportunities, in my opinion, of the current scale-up of antiretroviral therapy, the huge resources going into programmatic scale-up, particularly in Africa, are sometimes unguided as far as knowledge is concerned. And I think we're missing opportunities for research piggybacked onto that programmatic expansion, including through the use of large, simple trials addressing very fundamental questions, such as, for example, the still unaddressed issue of when to start antiretroviral therapy in general. I think one of the biggest concerns in all of this, raised today by Jerry Friedland, has got to be the implications of MDR and XDR on the HIV epidemic in Africa. Highlighted, but South Africa, but we don't really know what's going on elsewhere terribly well. Sort of the potential to have sort of New York City in the South, if you will, the impressive situation in New York City in the late 1980s, early 90s, could be playing out unrecognized in Southern Africa, and the implications of XDR really extremely serious. Perhaps the worst potential being the concept developing that actually it's dangerous to look after patients with HIV or with tuberculosis, not because you yourself might get tuberculosis, but because you as a healthcare worker might actually get incurable tuberculosis. And I think that's an extremely serious issue we need to be thinking about. It also raises the very important issues of healthcare system strengthening, and particularly laboratory capacity on the African continent in the face of these of this emerging threat in a way that we really haven't discussed seriously up till now. I think I'll stop because of time. I'll stop my comments there. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Leacock. I invite Dr. Barbara Lawn from the NIH.
Thanks very much. I'll just make a few brief remarks. I'm here representing the U.S. National Institutes of Health, the NIH, which is part of our broader Department of Health and Human Services. And NIH really is the primary research component of that department. And we have been supporting, continue to support, a broad and comprehensive research portfolio on tuberculosis, and to a large extent, to a larger extent, a portfolio on HIV/AIDS research. We've been working for some time, as you've heard today, on several studies, which are randomized controlled clinical trials, which are ongoing, and hopefully will begin to address the HIV/TB co-infection issues. HIV/TB is primarily supported through the Division of AIDS at NIAID, although we have within the broader scope of the NIH other institutes, such as the National Institute on Child Health and Development, the National Institute of Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, as well as the Fogarty International Center, all of which have begun to work together to try to improve our capacity and our level of funding for HIV/TB. As a piece of that, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases has recently published online a comprehensive research agenda for MDR, XDR, TB that have identified several major areas. This doesn't recommend, this isn't really a call with funds allocated already for it, but it's rather a discussion among the experts within our institute of where the gaps are and where additional funds would be needed to support new emerging areas. And we've identified this very much the same areas that we've heard about today, primarily new TB diagnostics, TB-HIV diagnostics, improving therapy for all forms of TB, better understanding of basic biology and immunology of TB and TB-HIV-infected individuals, studying through epidemiology the MDR, XDR epidemic as it affects HIV populations, enhancing the clinical management of drug resistance in people with and without HIV/AIDS, and improving TB prevention strategies, including vaccines. So this agenda was presented at our research council in May of 2007, and there have been some activities in the U.S. government in the congressional arena for identifying additional support for NIH, which we have not yet realized. But despite that, I would say that we are very open and invite these kinds of research questions to be submitted as investigator-initiated requests for support through grants within our current funding system. And we encourage research studies that will be broad in the sense of not only understanding basic biology, but also approaching better management in other sites around the world. We look forward to collaborating with our sister funding agencies in other nations and in other multinational organizations, and hope that we can bring things together better to coordinate our research activities, such as our recently funded large clinical trials networks, which have broad activities in many countries affected by the HIV epidemic. We've been working closely with PEPFAR, with some of the Gates-funded public-private partnerships. We've increased our portfolio on multi-drug-resistant TB through our biodefense initiatives. Stop TB partnership is an activity that we continue to be active in. And as part of the, as was mentioned, with the implementation of assistance through the rollout through PEPFAR, there certainly are opportunities for the bottom-up applications of countries to propose studies that could be considered public health evaluations that we are emphasizing this year through PEPFAR support for HIV-TB in particular. So this would be an important time with the upcoming country operating plans for PEPFAR for countries to, and the implementing partners to propose activities in some of these research areas that I've mentioned. I'd like to also mention that the Fogarty International Center is looking at some imaginative ways to improving capacity through training and through, and Dr. Jean McDermott, who's here from Fogarty, could speak more about that if anyone's interested afterwards. And lastly, the National Institute of Child Health and Development is considering having a request for proposals fairly soon, which would deal with childhood HIV-TB, both in the area of treatment and diagnosis. So I guess my main message is NIH wants to continue to play in the world stage in close collaboration with our partners, the ANRS, the Gates-funded initiatives, CREATE, as closely as possible, and to encourage investigators to please submit proposals on many of these important questions and do it through our normal granting mechanisms three times a year. I very much would like to receive more. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Our final panelist is Dr. Javier Blanc from ANRS.
So thanks a lot. First of all, I'd like to say... Is it working? First of all, I'd like to say that I'm here because the director of the ANRS, Professor Jean-François Delfrécy, will only arrive in Sydney later in this afternoon. So he asked me to represent him and to tell you key facts about NRS. NRS is a French national agency for research on HIV/AIDS and hepatitis. 97% of its budget comes from public resources, from government, only 3% from private companies. 97% of the funds directly support research projects. It's divided in six sections: basic research, clinical research, social science, vaccines, research in low-income countries or developing countries, and research on hepatitis. To get funded, it's basically a bottom-up process. There are two calls for proposal each year, due to the 15th of March and the 15th of September. All the projects are examined by independent panel of experts. Then the answers are given at the end of June and at the end of December each year. INRS works in 8 sites all over the world, 5 in Africa, Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso, Senegal, Cameroon, and Egypt, recently opened in April 2007. 2 sites in Southeast Asia, Vietnam and Cambodia, and 1 site in Brazil. These sites involve several researchers, and there is an agreement between usually Ministry of Health and local people who work since a long time ago. And then the sites can propose applications to get funded. But basically, even if you don't belong to any site, you can submit application to NRS, given the fact that this research is linked with a French team working in low-income country. For example, there is a big study that is called Temprano study, and it's the current budget for that study is 3.4 million euros. But you should multiply that by 2 or 2.5 to have the real cost of the project if you include the salaries and so on. So basically, 2 calls for proposal per year, 15th of March and 15th of September. Applications in English or French, but you need to involve French researchers working in low-income countries to get funded. And there will be a top-bottom meeting for TB and AIDS probably at the end of this year.
Thank you very much. The time is short. Can we put the mic on, please? Time is short. We have time for 1 or 2 questions, and I'd like to make a few closing comments. Mark?
This is Mark Harrington from Treatment Action Group. Just wanted to make 2 points in 1 question. The first point is that the global architecture around provision of treatment for the global killer infectious diseases, AIDS, TB, and malaria, has gotten far ahead of the global architecture for R&D on the 3 diseases. And the best example of that is the NIH funding levels for the 3 diseases, which they spend 10% of their budget on HIV research, 0.5% on TB, and 0.3% on malaria. And the reason is, I think, is largely due to political advocacy and congressional pressure. And so just the old-fashioned investigator-initiated research is not going to work without a major infusion of new funds. And so the U.S. people, Congress, and government need to make a new agreement about investing in global killer diseases to bring up the investment levels. And so do the other donor governments and the high-burden ones. And so I think the second point is that there needs to be a consensus, I think, building meeting between the global donors of R&D and the high-burden countries about how to fund this research, because the amounts of research going into TB and malaria and the others are grossly under the need. And so TB research gets $400 million a year, of which only 4% goes to diagnostics. And as Jerry said, that research area needs a lot more respect, not only in TB but also in HIV, with the need for better point-of-care tests for viral load and CD4. Second point is, we're going to be coming back to some of the people on the stage and asking you how much you invested in TB R&D last year to supplement our report that came out a year ago showing the investment levels for the year before. And so I guess I would just like to ask, particularly Dr. Kazachkin and Dr. Zudi and Dr. Long, how your agencies are going to address these particular issues. Because according to our report, Global Fund is funded about 0.5% of the TB R&D in 2005. Dr. Zudi, the World Bank through TDR funded an equal amount, but TDR's total research budget is about $6 million. It's totally inadequate to its mandate. And then Dr. Lon, the MDR, you know, R&D agenda specifies that it won't be able to carry out the agenda without new funds. What is the scale of the new funds needs that internally your program has identified as being needed to carry out the M and XDRTB R&D agenda?
So could you just make a quick response to Mark? I think he's really asking the immediate plans. I think everyone knows it's incremental is not going to do what we need. It's exponential. And so I maybe just a quick comment, Barbara, from you, kind of immediate plans with this. And Deborah Work, you as well, Michelle.
Well, I must say that I must quote, for what is needed, the quote must really come from others who have evaluated the portfolios of NIH. The current bill before the Congress calls for an additional $300 million for all departments of Health and Human Services, and that includes CDC and others who are members of the Federal TB Task Force. The amount for NIH is in that bill, I think, maybe on the order of $100 million. So not being able to really comment on internal discussions, I can say that I think those are appropriate numbers and potentially a doubling of our budget, which is about what they are suggesting in this area, would go a long ways to funding what has been proposed.
Deborah, it seemed like you were making a new commitment to increase funds. Is that correct? Just briefly mention that. And I think, Michelle, you had talked about the China initiative also, which was very exciting.
The way the bank works is it's totally demand-driven. If countries come to us with a TB program and request for funding, we will fund them. Mark, to your question, how much last year? The total funding for infectious diseases was over $700 million, and last year, $357 million went to communicable diseases. As I prefaced in the first sentence of my talk, we know we are not doing enough on TB. We will do much more than this. We won't do it alone. We will do it with all our partners. But as I said, I would emphasize it's completely demand-driven.
Michelle, any final comments?
Thank you. Mark, as you know, R&D, funding R&D is not in the mandate of the Global Fund. So the mandate of the Global Fund is to mobilize resources to fund implementation of prevention, treatment, care, and support in the three diseases. We're currently spending about $2 billion per year. As you know, the board has recently endorsed the fact that we could grow to spend up to $6 or even $8 billion per year by 2010. TB, as I said, represents about, I don't think I gave that number, but TB represents approximately 15% of our investments. We're present in over 100 countries. I'd like to say that the TB programs are among the most successful at the Global Fund. The rate of acceptance of TB programs by the TRP is around 60%, where it's around 40% or a little less for HIV and less for malaria. Thanks to the strength of TB programs in countries and of the Stop TB partnership that is so helpful. But again, to answer directly your question, there's no R&D in our mandate.
Thank you. Let me just wrap up then with a couple of summary comments. I think we've heard part of the scope of the urgent and life-threatening problems that need to be addressed in the HIV-TB research agenda. I think we've heard from our panelists what their organizations are committed to addressing these questions. That being said, we're here in an audience with all the people that care about this. But I must say, and those of you who've gone to these meetings for many years, we need to get beyond making lists of things to do. We sit here and we say, this is what we need to do. This is what we need to do. And, you know, I was thinking about this, that there was a lipid meeting before this meeting. I'm like, why aren't we having an HIV-TB meeting? Well, we don't have enough data to justify it. And the reason we don't have enough data to justify it is because we need more investment in HIV research. So I realize you're the advocates, okay? I'm not. But we have to go beyond where we do. And I think part of that could be with some synergies. There has to be new funding in this area. In the meantime, because as Kevin pointed out, there's a lot of missed opportunities. You know, HIV is fortunately not a one-year disease. It's a 40 to 50-year disease, and people are going to be getting TB again. So I would appeal to the audience, the researchers, as Kevin said, not only at the regular things we're thinking about, we need to think outside the box. Certainly the community, Mark, the activists need to keep promoting the agenda. And I would really ask each of our funders, based on this meeting and what you've heard, if there's anything you want from the researcher community about the importance of this, please let us know and go back to your groups and let them know this is the moment where we really need to ramp up support for HIV-TB research. So with that, thank you very much, and I hope you're able to participate in the TB events. I want to point out the Shack and Dialogues photography exhibits in the Bayside Terrace. Alistair gave me this brochure. I haven't seen it myself. It just looks phenomenal, so I hope everyone's able to go. Thank you.